Please the court. I'm Joshua Gordon. I represent the defendant, Dorian Hite. I'll take my 5 minutes. When deciding this case, I urge you to consider this. If you had something illegal in your pocket or in your car and were stopped for a taillight violation, would you consent to a search? Or this, if a friend, upon being asked to consent to a search during an automobile stop, called you on his cell phone and asked, should I consent, would an attorney ever say, yes, go ahead, especially if the client was carrying contraband? The answer to these questions is so obvious that, at least to lawyers, it's almost humorous. Barring a creative hypothetical, it is always a bad idea to consent. So why did Mr. Hite, knowing he had contraband in his pocket, consent to a search? Why do people say yes? And nearly everyone does. They think they have a duty to, or they think they're required to, or somehow they think they'll appease the police. But none of these reasons are voluntary. None of these reasons are motivated by free will. Voluntariness is not credible unless it serves some private motive. The United States Supreme Court recognized that principle in its Miranda decision regarding confessions. In this case, the go-ahead that Mr. Hite gave to the search was not a chipper, gosh, I'd love you to search me, as the state seems to suggest. It was a go-ahead of resignation, of submission, of total knowledge that this cop was going to get what he wanted. And cops get consent. They're trained to. Police behavior is designed to exploit the seamless transition and subtle transition between a traffic stop, the transition from a traffic stop to consensual conversation. Law enforcement, as an institution, knows that people say yes. The police are trained to get consent because they know it works. And they get consent virtually every time they ask. In New Jersey, the law has been since 1975 that for a valid consent, the state must show that the defendant had knowledge of the right to refuse. New Jersey has a standard consent form for that purpose. There's a whole line of cases on the matter. The New Jersey court relied on its own constitution, Part 1, Article 7, and specifically rejected the U.S. Supreme Court Schneckelaw case, and that's State v. Johnson, cited in my brief. Mr. Hite was stopped for speeding and an out taillight. Officer Graves approached the car. This is a standard speeding sort of stop. Mr. Hite gave the officer his license and registration. Graves questioned Hite about where he was going to and where he was coming from. Graves went back to his cruiser, checked out Hite's license and registration, which were fine. Now Officer Graves, instead of dropping a ticket in Mr. Hite's lap, ordered Mr. Hite out of the car without probable cause or any articulable suspicion. Graves quizzed Hite further about Boston and frat parties, all without reasonable suspicion. And out on the side of the road, not surprisingly, Graves managed to get Hite's consent to search the car. Search not only his car, but his person, his wallet, and his pockets. Sometime later in the evening, Mr. Hite's license and registration were returned to him. It is settled law. Traffic stops cannot be longer than necessary to carry out the purpose of the stop. In this case, ticket for speeding and a taillight. The state has conceded that there was no reasonable suspicion for detention beyond the time necessary to give Mr. Hite a ticket. Is there to be no consequences when the state detains citizens illegally? If not, police abuses are condoned. Any evidence developed after the time Officer Graves needed to issue a speeding ticket, is ill-gotten and must be suppressed.
Mr. Gordon, I just have a question about how you're going about this. You've cited cases, federal and state cases, but no reference to the Constitution, either the federal or state Constitution in your brief. Is that a problem?
It is a problem, and I apologize for it. I noticed that myself several days ago. But I'm clearly arguing in opposition to the recent Robinette case, which is on federal grounds, and I intended to raise the state constitution, and that, in fact, is what was done below.
The state really hasn't seemed to challenge you on your failure to be specific about the state and federal constitutions.
No, and I think the issue is fairly understandable.
If we find the consent was voluntary here, do you lose?
Well, I have to answer that in several different ways.
Yes or no.
No, consent can't be consensual, and I want to stop the analysis before consent, before any reasonable suspicion. Mr. Height could not consent to this. He did not voluntarily do it.
But under your theory, every time a police officer asks for consent, it's involuntary. Right.
Well, no, I think there are several different solutions. If there's some unmistakable break in time or unmistakable indication that there are we've now stopped our traffic stop, our Terry stop, and we've gone to consensual conversation, that's okay. If the officer says, you're free to go, or you don't have to answer these questions, or you don't have to consent to a search, but I'm going to ask you to, that's fine.
Plus, this is an illegal stop. So are you saying to us that a consent given no matter when and how following an illegal stop should not be permitted? We should not clear the taint? Are you separating it to that extent?
Yes, I think so. At some point, the purposes of the Terry stop ceases. And that point is at the time where the officer has enough time to give a ticket. At that time, that is the end of the allowable stop. And if there is coercive circumstances in which the defendant is, non-voluntarily consents.
I guess I'm trying to separate those two things out. I understand the argument that if there is no consent because it's coercive or non-voluntary or any of those things that we're arguing occurred as a result of the facts in this case, that there is no consent. But before that time, the state concedes this is an illegal stop. So are you urging that whenever there's an illegal stop, a consent, even if freely given, should not be able to cure that taint?
Well, I don't think the state has conceded that this is an illegal stop. I mean, Mr. Height had an out taillight and a speeding ticket. I think
the detention
afterwards. When the detention is illegal, any evidence gained therefrom has to be excluded.
What they're saying is that you can have an illegal stop, which is the second one in this instance, an illegal detention after the legal stop.
Right.
The state concedes that there was an illegal detention. The question that I have is, do we accept their argument that a voluntarily given consent after that point can cure that thing?
It can, if there are some unmistakable circumstances indicating to the defendant that there was knowledge, that the defendant had knowledge of his right to refuse. But if the legal stop ends and it seamlessly transfers into a consensual conversation and the defendant never had any indication of that, the defendant still feels, as Mr. Height did, he was out of the car after all, that he was compelled to answer the officer's questions and compelled to answer them in a particular way, then no, it's possible. Given the state's concession, it is possible to have consent if there is some unmistakable break in the circumstances, some unmistakable way that the defendant knew he could go or didn't have to consent.
So you require a warning. If the detention continues beyond the ticket and it's illegal, then you say the police have to warn.
Well, I don't think that warning is the only way to go about it. One commentator suggested that there should be no consent possible because that would always be the lawyer's advice. Another has said that if the police returns documents and then indicates by some unmistakable behavior, that's sufficient.
But that changes the nature of the second stop.
Second stop.
What if he returns everything and the person's staying in his car and he says, by the way, before you drive off, I have this question, that the person knows he can drive away. What we're talking about is a situation in which that doesn't occur, that he now still has his license, that he orders him out of the car, that he begins to ask him questions out of the car, the inference being that he's now not free to go.
Right.
So we're at the stage where he's not free to go.
Right. When he's not free to go.
So it's unlike Robinette. It doesn't work police officer says you're free to go, because this person wasn't free to go.
That's right. The facts here are one step worse than the Robinette case.
He didn't have his license and registration.
No. No.
So can it be cured by the police officer saying, you're not free to go, but can I have your consent to search you or your car?
You're not free to go, and you have a right to say no to the following question: may I search your car?
And that would be okay.
That would be okay. If he just says you're free to go, which he clearly wasn't without his license and registration. But if he gives back the license and registration, and there's some break in time, or there's some indication verbally or through acts that he doesn't have to answer the questions or consent to search, that's okay. The other way to...
But then, of course, the police officer bootstraps himself into a reasonably articulable suspicion when the detained individual says, oh, I don't have to let you search my car. Well, then I'm not going to. Oh, well, he won't let me search his car. That must mean he's got something to hide.
Oh, well, wait a minute. No. Just because a person exercises their Fourth Amendment, Article 19 rights doesn't give any officer articulable suspicion to believe something's the matter.
That would be, oh, well, wait a minute, Your Honor.
Excuse me, Your Honor. When there's exercise of rights is not a reason to deny the person his right to say no.
I understand that. That's not the point I was making. The point that I was making is the next thing that happens is the police officer arrests him, detains him further, and then tries to persuade somebody to let him search the car. Whether he can or can't, he's just got Mr. Hyde out there in the street into a deeper hole than he's already been in.
Okay, let me see if I understand this. Mr. Hyde, knowing his rights, says, no, you may not.
Right.
I don't believe that's articulable suspicion.
Is he going to let him go?
Well, I think he has to if he's got no other reason to hold him.
Well, he shouldn't have gotten him out of the car in the first place tonight, and he did, right?
He did, and he should not have. But say Mr. Hyde was in the car. Let's say it's the, you know, and he had given back the license and registration even, and says, may I search your car? And Mr. Hyde says no. I think Mr. Hyde can leave then.
Should have been able to. He should never have been taken out of the car.
Yes, you're right. And for that reason, once that detention, I think, triggers the lack of any ability for the officer to ask those questions, make the further detention, and specifically ask the question, may I have your consent to search?
But under our cases, the lack of cooperation is a factor to be considered in determining reasonable suspicion.
I am hoping that exercise of one's Fourth Amendment and Article 19 rights is not considered lack of cooperation.
Of course it is.
Well,
if the police rap on the door and you rudely respond to it, there's a case that I lost some years ago where that's considered a lack of cooperation, and it's a factor to be considered whether or not the police can enter.
But supposing you don't do it rudely. No, thank you, officer.
It doesn't matter
officer.
How polite you are, it's still lack of cooperation.
Well, I am...
Terry says that. Failure to respond to the police in an inquiry is a factor to be considered.
I think a no, Your Honor, I'll exercise my rights... ought not to be considered lack of cooperation for those purposes. That's an exercise of
rights. Mr. Gordon, when you started out, I thought you were asking for a broader rule than you now seem to be arguing for. You would like this court to craft a rule that says if you are being illegally detained, it's like the fruit of the poisonous tree, consent following that, absent some express statement that you have a right to refuse, is invalid consent. You're not asking for a general statement that any time you stop a motorist, even if they're lawfully detained, and you ask them, can I search your car, you have to precede that with a warning? Or is it just after an illegal detention?
Well, I have provided in my brief a smattering of possibilities that the court could adopt. The current situation, I'm arguing, does not work. But there are several different ways I think the court could craft a rule that would solve the problem. One would be, like you have just articulated, that there, after the detention ends, you cannot consent. if I understand your meaning. One could be a Miranda type of rule. One could be the New Jersey type of rule. There are several others. I think there is a problem in need of a solution, and I can argue for several of them. Any of them are better than the totality rule that exists now.
If we're going to go that route, the police would probably rather have a rule that says, ask for consent every time, because they don't realize necessarily that their detention is illegal. So I mean, it would be an odd circumstance where the officer says, I know this is illegal, so I better now give them kind of a Miranda right on consent to search. They'd probably give the right routine.
I believe that the Miranda type rule is the best one. It's a bright line rule. New Jersey is just short of that, but it's I think Miranda is the best rule for the reasons you articulate. No further questions, I'll sit down.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Stephen Fuller, representing the state of New Hampshire. I'd like to start just by treating the defendant's contention that it is somehow unreasonable to think that somebody in this situation would ever consent, especially if they that they believe that they were carrying contraband. And that kind of a proposition would require overturning dozens of cases that this court has already decided where consent was found to be freely given and the police found contraband. This court in State v. Weber, which I believe the state lost, but did say that it is not per se unreasonable to refuse consent to search, even if you know that you're carrying contraband.
But Mr. Gordon didn't, in his oral argument, say anything about the fact that the defendant, he was African American, that he was traveling in a car with two Caucasians who were not searched, that he was determined to have a valid license, and before giving it back, unlike the usual automobile stop, he orders him out of his car and then begins to question him. Isn't there something that is offensive about dealing with that without recognizing that, contrary to your assertion, the person in that situation is highly unlikely to resist the police officer?
Well, I'll start by saying a couple of things. The fact that the defendant is black and that the other two passengers are white and that the police officer was white was brought to the attention of the trial court, but in only the most cursory fashion. The arguments presented in the defendant's brief were never briefed below or never presented below
those
to the trial
facts.
Court.
They're not arguments, they're facts. I mean, it's a fact that the driver was African-American. It's a fact that the police officer decided to order him out of his car because when he asked him why he went to Boston, he said he went to Boston to hang out. It's a fact the police officer said, one of the reasons I asked him out is because he's hanging out in Boston, where we know drugs are sold. I mean, it's a fact. It's not an argument.
True. But the defendant doesn't claim that even given all those facts that Officer Graves stopped him because of his race. What he's claiming is that the defendant's behavior is explained because of his race, because he's thinking the easiest way for me to get out of this was the least amount.
He didn't stop him because of his race. But you have no concern whatsoever that he asked him out of his car and asked him where he was going and why he was there, that didn't have anything to do with it whatsoever?
First of all, there's no evidence on the record that that had anything to do with it whatsoever.
But isn't it a factor to be considered in the voluntariness of the consent? Just as the difference in size between two people, difference in race, difference in age, may be factors to be considered in determining the voluntariness of the consent.
If there was something before the court below in evidence to show why the difference in race in this particular, or the difference in size, or the difference in age, or the difference in...
Well, he didn't search the other two guys, and they're with him. They went the same place with him, and they're in the same car. Isn't that an indication?
Well, the defendant was the driver of the car, and he's the one who committed the speeding violation.
But he's got a valid license and a valid registration, and maybe we should just credit him with the fact that he didn't play too much of the race card in the trial below, so to speak.
Well,
I mean, obviously it's something that troubles the court. This is a very big piece of this case.
Whether or not Officer Graves stopped him or asked him questions because of his race, really, his subjective beliefs and his prejudice and his racism, if he has any, and I don't say that he does, isn't part of the analysis of whether the consent was voluntary.
Well, sure, because Mr. Height is trying to calculate all of that while he's out there illegally being detained on the side of the road in determining what he ought to do about this.
Perhaps he is, but his motivations for consent are also irrelevant. Even if he gave consent and in his mind was thinking, I really don't want to consent, but I will just to get this over with, that's fine. His motivations are also irrelevant.
Motivations are relevant if they're based on objective facts.
Well, the objective, if looking at the facts, as the officer would look at them, if he believed that he had valid consent, that is the standard. But I'm saying that if there's no outward sign from the defendant that he was consenting under protest or reluctantly, then how is the officer supposed to decide whether a black motorist is giving valid consent or not?
Does it help Mr. Height at all if he says, you're just doing this to me because I'm African-American, but go ahead, search my car? I mean, how does that help Mr. Height? I don't expect that it would make the situation any better.
Well, it would have helped Mr. Height if he had just said no.
Well, then shouldn't we, in order to get rid of all these tenuous questions and feelings and beliefs, just adopt the bright line that Mr. Gordon says and say, listen, when you stop somebody and ask them for their consent, from now on you've got to give them a warning so we don't have to worry about all these things and what people's motivations are. How difficult is that? By the way, I've got some questions I want to ask you. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. How does that hurt law enforcement? And don't we all fare better as a society if every citizen, tall, short, black, white, gets that kind of warning on the highway in the middle of the night because somebody's told them they've gone to Boston to hang out, now they're subject to police officers questioning? What's the harm? Is there a greater benefit to society than harm to the police?
Well, greater benefit to society, harm to the police, these are all social questions that this court and the legislature can ruminate over. The narrow question in this case is what is constitutionally required and what is constitutionally permissible. And under Part 1, Article 19, what is constitutionally required is the police officer to have a reasonable belief that the consent was voluntary.
Well, why wouldn't we do this? Does it make any difference to you? In this case, it was illegal detention after a lawful stop, right?
Yes, that there was a lawful Terry stop. And
would
then,
it matter to you whether the stop was unlawful and the consent were asked for? Or doesn't matter?
Under the totality of the circumstances standard, the lawfulness of the stop is certainly something to throw into the equation.
Why don't we
matter just as every fact matters.
In Manchester, New Hampshire, where I live, why don't we send the police officers down to Lake Avenue between the hours of 11 and 2 a.m. and stop every car with people under the age of 21 with no basis to stop them? Once they stop them, say, do you mind if we search your car? And I'll bet half the time, if not more, they'd say, okay. And you would say, well, okay, the stop was unlawful, but they gave a voluntary consent.
Well,
and half the time we'd find stuff we could never find otherwise. Why don't we do that?
Even if the stop is unlawful, the flagrancy of the stop is definitely a factor to consider under the federal cases that have looked at this issue. Now, that I would, under your hypothetical, I would submit is a completely pretextual, flagrant stop. Here, what we have is a legal stop sort of morphing into a request for consent, and if it is, and it depends on how the police officer does that. If the police officer says that, you know, your car is going to be towed, I'm not going to give you back your license, if he says something like that, then certainly there's an element of coercion there. But here, someone waiting in the car for the police officer legitimately to check out his license,
In this case, the officer knows or should know. This stop is over.
Granted, yes, we do
okay,
grant
so
that.
So the officer knows or should know that he's now going beyond where he should be. It's the middle of the night. He's got some poor fellow, black, white, or otherwise, the side of the road. Why don't we do the fruit of the poisonous tree analysis? You would never have the opportunity to ask the person if you weren't illegally detaining them. Why should you benefit from your illegal conduct? Why is that any different than a lot of Fourth Amendment cases where you say, we don't have a good faith exception?
Well, the question then becomes, under fruit of the poisonous tree, I guess, the question then becomes, is there enough of a separation between the illegal conduct and the consent for us to say that the consent was still voluntary?
What about Florida versus Roy? Remember Roy? Roy was detained in the airport. Court held he's illegally arrested. The consent occurs during the illegal arrest. And the court says that's it. The consent doesn't launder somehow the search. It's out.
Well, because there were no other circumstances that would have cleaned the tank.
They didn't look at any other circumstances. They just said the consent occurred during a period of illegal arrest. And I know there are a lot of federal circuits that you cite in your brief that have tried to make that into a mushier standard. But the fact is, the U.S. Supreme Court's already decided this issue, as far as I can tell.
No, we don't think that it's that black and white, because otherwise none of those federal circuits would have decided for the state in those instances. I mean, and cert was denied on a lot of those cases. You'd think that the U.S. Supreme Court would have said something about them if that were the case.
Why wouldn't we want to adopt a black-letter rule, it might seem unreasonable, in a situation where the police officers have illegally detained someone? They don't benefit from the illegal detention. What's wrong with that black-letter rule? Why should we give the police the benefit of an illegal act, an unlawful act?
Because a bright-line rule would contradict the totality of the circumstances standard, and that standard is based on the requirement of reasonableness in both the Fourth Amendment and Article 19, which separates the Fourth Amendment from, say, Miranda under the Fifth or waiving your right to trial under the Sixth. Under the Fourth Amendment and Article 19, you have a reasonableness standard. That means totality of the circumstances. A bright-line rule ignores the reasonableness requirement in those statutory...
The reasonableness of the stop, is what you're talking about?
No, the reasonableness of believing that he had valid consent.
But what I'm saying, in a situation where they're holding a person unlawfully, that becomes the 800-pound gorilla on the scale of reasonableness under the totality test. And most frequently, if not always, you lose. Right? And what's wrong with that?
Well, but in that case, you're still applying the totality of the circumstances standard. The defense is arguing for a new standard, for a bright-line rule. And we're saying that even if we lose under the totality standard is the correct standard. A bright-line rule is not necessary. The U.S. Supreme Court has said so in both Schneckloth v. Bustamante and Ohio v. Robinette. This court has cited Schneckloth v. Bustamante with approval in several other cases that I cite in my brief. This is the standard under both the state and the federal constitution. We'd have to throw out that standard if we adopt this rule.
You would say to me, under a totality test, maybe a per se rule is better, but under a totality test, if I detain you unlawfully for 30 minutes in the middle of the night by the side of the road, and then I say, can I search your car? We might get a different result than if I detained you unlawfully for 5 minutes in the middle of the night and asked you if I could search your car.
Because the timing of the detention is another fact to consider. That's exactly totality of the circumstances.
Are all illegal detentions from the first second, are they all of equal stature? Do we look at the flagrancy that you said about?
The flagrancy of the violation is definitely a factor.
What's more flagrant than being a citizen in your car with a valid license, you should get a ticket and the police officer leave, than to have you taken out of your car because you said you were going to Boston to hang out? Well, what's more flagrant than that?
Well, if you're asking for a hypothetical, I can think of a lot of things that the police can do beyond what this officer can do.
In New Hampshire, the law is that police can arrest people for motor vehicle violations, and then I suppose it would follow that unless this court were to find it's pretextual, that they can search the car incident to the arrest, or the person incident to the arrest.
Well, that's a situation that we don't have in this case because he didn't arrest him before the search.
And this overlaps, I think. Right?
Well, it's...
Person was stopped for a motor vehicle violation, and then one way or another it elevates itself to what we're dealing with here today.
Well, if those were the facts of this case, I mean, it's also the law in New Hampshire that a Terry stop can only extend to the reasonable suspicion.
This is a stop for motor vehicle violation. Speeding, going over the yellow line, your taillights off.
Right, so the police officer then decides what he's going to do about it after checking the license and registration. He obviously doesn't have to arrest the motorist. Usually they get a ticket. But once whatever he does is over, then the Terry stop is over.
So it's
not going to end in an arrest necessarily.
Even under a totality test. What time of the night or day did this happen?
This was 7 or 8 o'clock at night, I think.
I'm sorry? Seven.
About 7 or 8 o'clock at night.
And he's pulled over, and he's taken out of his car. Police officer is holding his license?
Yes.
But he hasn't returned it?
No.
And he says, can I search your car? And can I search you? and kind of search your wallet, in so many words. Why wouldn't we, under just a totality test, say, that's not right? Because I suspect, reasonably, objectively, most citizens would feel intimidated under those circumstances and not free to say, give me my license back the night chatting with you. I mean, just on a totality basis, why don't we say that doesn't make it?
Well, because since we're looking at the totality, we also have to look at everything that was said, by the way. It's not just he says, I'd like to search your car. The police officer explains his reasoning. He says that he wants to search for drugs. And he explains that the reason he wants to search for drugs is because he knows that people who go to Boston sometimes get drugs and bring them back to college.
You know, I went to Boston just last week.
Step outside, please.
Yeah, step outside. I always have a chat with you and check your pocketbook. Now, this really doesn't strike you as not reasonable conduct on the part of the police officer?
Well, when asking for consent is an exception not only to the warrant requirement, but to any reasonable suspicion or probable cause. I mean, under Terry and its progeny, the police can walk up to anybody on the street and ask them questions.
If he's got his license, his registration, shouldn't they at least be saying, look, here's your ticket, here's your license and registration. You're free to go, but because you just came from Boston and whatever else, I'd like to search your car for drugs. Do you give me permission to do so?
We agree that he should have given him his license back and that the Terry stop was over. The question then is when the police officer explains himself and the defendant is friendly and cordial and this conversation happens in a pretty friendly atmosphere, and there doesn't seem to be...
That's to be encouraged if you're stopped by a policeman, I guess.
Well, all I can say is that given the findings of the trial court listened to the witness, and that's what the trial court found.
Other than the voluntariness of the consent, is there any other intervening circumstance between the illegal detention and the consent that you're arguing?
It happens in a... admittedly, in a very short period of time.
And I know that, but as a legal principle, essentially we have to hold that the voluntariness of the consent standing alone vitiates the illegality of the detention here and justifies the search in order to uphold this conviction.
Yes, so you look at whether the illegal detention affected the defendant's decision to consent.
What about, can I ask you a question?
The burden's on you. The burden's on the other way to show that it did.
Correct. That's
what about the fact the police officer said, do you mind if I pat you down and search your pockets for drugs? And the defendant says no, and he searches them, and he doesn't find drugs. He finds a small container. He never asked him if he could open the container. Did he have consent to open the container? Or did he have consent to open containers if he finds them? Isn't that the problem with the consent? What's wrong with the rule that says, you know, most people barely know their civics lesson, let alone that they don't have to yield to an officer who says, can I pat you down and search you? What's wrong with just saying, from now on, when you ask somebody for their consent, you have to tell them they don't have to give it?
If the officer had said that, we wouldn't find anything wrong with it. The question is whether the Constitution requires it, and it doesn't. That's the question.
Do you know of any states that have followed what the Ohio court held in Robinette?
Actually, the Ohio court didn't even follow what the Ohio court held.
I know they did on remand. Were there any other states that did?
No.
Picked up on
not that I found.
Thank you. Please submit it.
Thank you.